Hi, I'm Logan Olivier. Welcome to the first episode of Live from the Living Room. Tonight's sponsor is Impact Promotions. Thank you very much for providing clothing for us for this episode. And without any further ado, here is our first guest of the show, Jamie Smith.
Here's the first take we've ever done. Happen to be in my living room. For those who have never seen me play before, I write really sad songs that are super depressing, so I apologize for ruining your Thursday. But hey, that's just how it goes. There's enough happy songs in the world. I'm just no good at them. I'd like to write happy songs. They just always sound terrible whenever I write them. Maybe these ones sound terrible to you too, I'm not really sure, but here we go. You good? Thank you.
settled down. My mind, it still races wild from time to time. And the wires settle down. My mind, it still races wild from time to time. What's the sense in running wild? Simply put, we've got too far to go. From time to time.
Beer opening was so good. Yeah. It's supposed to be live. Like, who, if you're not drinking beer at a live show,
were you really?
Kind of enhances it, really.
Yeah. Yeah.
Especially with sad songs, too. We need a little bit here.
It's a real unsung hero. Kind of sad.
Alright, I'm probably gonna mess this next song up.
No.
It's about drinking too much for way too long. My kids named it Baby Sparkle Unicorn for some reason.
Nice.
I don't know.
Wait, he was drinking?
The kids, they got problems. They're 5 and 3. They're from Westport.
Oh.
Hey, so am I. I don't even want to tell you what the kids in North would do.
Oh.
Hey. Hey. Sorry, I'm just going to tune quickly. You don't want the tuning song? All right.
We're good.
Good? Okay. Drinking a nondescript beer. No logo on it at all.
Thank you. been bored since I've been here. Now the bottle left me. It's like a decade long hour. Now the bottle left me. So they say I should quit thinking, 'cause I ain't never been that good at it. And if I quit everything I wasn't good at, I'd have something. No, well, goddamn everything, 'cause I ain't never been that good at it. No, well, goddamn everything, 'cause I ain't never been that good at it. No, well, goddamn everything. No, well, goddamn everything. I've been bored since I've been here, since the bottle took me. Since the bottle took me in.
Drink to that.
Yeah.
So this is my last one. Last song of the super long set. I have no idea what this song is about. I
probably drinking.
It could be, yeah. No, this one's just a song.
Fall down.
Thank you, Spontaneous Living Room.
Thank you.
Yeah.
All right, Jamie Smith, welcome to the show, live from Living Room. We've known each other for a long time. I'm the host, Logan Olivier. We used to work in the media back in the day, and one of the things that I want to talk about today is what it's like to be in the media in this day and age, where it's insanity, like fake news and alternative facts. And that's very difficult to even kind of navigate what is right and what's true and what to listen to. And you had some interesting thoughts on that.
I couldn't even imagine right now. You know, the most recent example is a local reporter was covering that United We Roll convoy that came through town on the weekend, and he tweeted that he was getting verbally abused and he was being called a liar. More and more, you know, it seems like it's becoming more and more difficult to do that job. I mean, there's just that guy in the States who got caught with all those guns and he had a list of all the reporters that he was going to kill. I mean, this is North America. It's just crazy that journalism is a dangerous thing to do, given that you think we're so far removed from that kind of thing. I mean, in terms of the alternate facts and all that, I just think there's a very concerted effort to cast doubt in people's minds about what's true and what's not. There's a myriad of factors as to why that's happening, but, you know, I would say social media is a pretty big part of that. And when you're one reporter versus thousands of internet trolls and algorithms that are clearly putting this in people's faces all the time, I mean, there's a pretty uphill battle.
For sure. And we were talking about social media and how, like, it almost seems very corrupt a lot of the times, and there's a lot of negativity around it, and algorithms and all of this stuff that was designed to kind of figure out what we're supposed to have in front of us based off of mathematical equations, and the people that kind of created that, I don't think they really had a clue what was going to happen. And we were talking about that, the big data and how that affects so much of our day-to-day life.
Yeah, like I don't think the, you know, the creators of YouTube or even Zuckerberg or anyone else, like, snidely whiplashing their mustache going, haha, I want to, you know, make people question the very basis of democracy. I think they just had some tech skills and they wanted to make some cool stuff, but I mean, you can't deny that they've sort of created these sort of data collection things that are having pretty unintended consequences. I think people are kind of seeing it a bit, but there's some talk now that, you know, big data and the way that, big tobacco was a thing for a very long time. And perhaps, you know, like, we don't realize the mental health effects alone of these sort of rage factories. Like, you look at the more engaging a post is, the more it's going to pop up in someone's feed. But what tends to engage people the most is that clickbait anger stuff, right? Like, sometimes, yeah, there's a heartwarming story of a dog that gets, you know, 30,000 likes, but more often than not, it's like a rage factory. And, like, again, I don't think that was anyone's intention. It's just kind of the way that it has evolved, but we're gonna have to figure it out.
Capitalizing on emotions is kind of the essence of a lot of advertising and marketing, even gaining influence. And you see a lot of, I guess, influencers in politics and in the global scale are using that emotion to try to get people to do kind of what they want, think what they want, which is a really weird concept, because you see a lot of people now that are believing things that doesn't really make a lot of sense for them to believe. You mentioned the pipeline truckers that came through, who are all for this pipeline and all for big oil and everything, which is an industry that kind of is just polluting the world at the expense of our futures. And nobody really seems to think anything beyond what they're being told, that everything is a lie with climate change and everything else. These people are trying to keep us from having good jobs and money. It's such a weird concept to think, like, why are we believing what these billionaire corporations are telling us?
Well, I think it's way easier to think that when you're bombarded with it day after day after day. I think it kind of breaks down your... It's exhausting to think critically about all of the information that's coming at us all the time, you know? So I think at a certain point, some people, especially
especially people who, you know, like I'm of the generation, I kind of remember before the internet, but I also remember, like, I remember having a 14-4 modem, you know? So, and then beyond that, you know, you see the kids today that are social media and internet savvy in ways that I never thought possible. Older generations, though, I think are having a bit more of an issue determining what is and isn't fact. I mean, when I see people, 9 times out of 10, the people who are sharing the LA Times article that actually LA Times is spelled wrong in the URL, typically the people are of a certain demographic, right? But yeah, I think it just wears you down, and at a certain point you can't think critically anymore. You're almost numb, and then you just kind of resort straight to anger, and then people are exploiting it. Even the so-called reporters who are pushing this sort of narrative and really encouraging this vitriol, you've seen a really big shift in even their tone from, say, 5-10 years ago to now. I think partly because, you know, getting those likes and those comments and those shares, it's like just kicking their dopamine up and they're addicted to it. And the more outrageous they are, the more clicks they get, the more that stuff is shared, and the more it's just sort of breaking down people's critical thinking skills.
Do you feel like it's kind of led us to the situation now where we don't really have any more middle ground? It's just two extremes on left and right. And if you aren't on one side, you have no allies and both sides hate you. But really the only sensible ground is in the middle. And it makes it very difficult to even have any kind of rational conversations on anything.
Yeah, the middle is always the first to go. If you look historically at any sort of like seismic political shift that happens, that middle moderate centrist view is always the first to go, because yeah, they can easily get attacked by both sides. I mean, you know, the one side will call you a traitor, and then the other side will say that you're not doing enough for the cause. But the other thing, though, is I mean, how much of that electronic life translates to real life, you know, which I always kind of find fascinating in that. In real life conversations, I mean, sometimes people say things that shock me, and it seems to be with more frequency, but it's not as bad in real life as it is. Even that United We Roll trucker thing that was supposed to be the grand revolution, they're rolling into Ottawa. They had like 300 people on Parliament Hill. I saw more people do yoga on Parliament Hill. legit, just showed up for a day in the park yoga than that entire thing got. And I would say That protest, whatever you want to call it, got more earned media attention than pretty much any movement I've seen in Canada. Probably more than Idle No More, which is pretty sad to say. And it still didn't really translate into even 1% of the sort of support that they seem to be getting online. So if there's one thing that I guess I'm still optimistic of, it's that our electronic brains have kind of turned to mush, but there's still hope in the real world.
Yeah, and it's really easy to get depressed when you see all the crap you see on social media and online and everything like that. But you see, like, the trend of humanity. And really, in the end, we've done a lot more good than bad. And this almost seems like just something that I think we're going to break through eventually. At least that's the hope. But being someone that was in the media and now isn't, and sees what is happening with, like, for example, I saw an article today, someone posted something about the Bear Clan, which is now being kicked out of Thunder Bay or removed as a chapter in Thunder Bay. And I saw a comment, someone was saying that they called Dougal Media, which we both worked for, the communist news network in Thunder Bay. Like, eventually, I feel like most people are going to be like, really? Let's start being sensible.
Well, you'd hope so. I mean, I think though media, I don't know how, and I think this whole unbiased thing has actually sort of hurt media in terms of, you know, really amping up their function in democracy and helping people with media literacy. Just simply because they're not really in defense of being unbiased, they're not saying things like, they're not combating things like that, right? Meanwhile, the people who are saying things like that have a Facebook page with 25,000 likes on it. which is getting liked and shared by tons of people and then popping up in everyone's feed all the time. So I hope that there might be a shift from the media itself to call that stuff out. I understand why no media wants to do it. They don't want to kind of, you know, get down in the mud, and it's, you know, supposed to sort of be beneath them. But I mean, at a certain point, yeah, like it's pretty clear that when you have people in real life saying that to reporters, like they said to Doug on the weekend, like there's a problem there.
Yeah. And how do you combat that? How is like an average person supposed to be like, how do I find out what is crap and what's real? And that's a difficult thing I think a lot of people have trouble with. They just kind of see stuff and accept it. Well, you know, my friend who I trust said this, and he's a pretty smart guy, and it must be real. Like, how do you even navigate that?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's the same way. Like, how do you convince someone that chemtrails aren't a thing and the Earth isn't actually flat and we aren't controlled by a cabal of lizard people? You know what I mean? Like, you gotta keep doing it. You gotta keep calling it out. I've made it a point to, whenever someone shares something now that's like really, really ridiculous, for the longest time I just kind of let it go, and now I'm not. And if I lose those people as friends, I mean, do I really care that a dude I used to like hang out with in high school, who now got his brain warped by rebel media, isn't going to be my Facebook friend anymore? I don't know, but there's a hope that if I actually challenge that meme that he's sharing with facts, that's going to maybe bump up the engagement of that post, and maybe someone will read that comment. I mean, I think it might just take an individual effort on everyone's part to call out that crap whenever they see it.
And do you think it's important to do that in a non-partisan way, where you're not saying like, oh, I'm all about, you know, this politician or this politician, and more be like, okay, I don't care who you vote for, but that thing you just said is utterly insane and wrong, and there's no factual evidence to support that.
Yeah, well, I mean, sure, as long, like, it'd be nice to rely on facts. Some people, I'm sure, will argue that anytime you are trying to combat that, is you're just partisan by default if you're questioning Ontario Proud in the first place, because aren't you super angry too, you know?
Immigrants are out to get us. Like, no, they're not.
Yeah, that's the thing, is like most of what these people are arguing is just like none of the evidence shows it at all.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm optimistic though.
So when Donald Trump was elected in the United States, I know there's a lot of people up here that are like, oh yeah, no, this is the American problem. Canadians are too sensible. We'll never let that happen. And then we seem to be seeing that exact thing happen up here. Is that something that like startled you as much as like I was pretty shocked when I see the amount of anger and like same divisive rhetoric that happens south of the border happening in Ontario even, and across, not so much out west, you kind of expect it, but like in Ontario, which is supposed to be like,
sure,
the liberalist capital of North America, they seem to be very much fallen in line with the rest of the United States.
But what you got to remember is those sort of like populist alt-right messages, that for lack of a better term, let's just call them populist messages, are hyper-focused on a certain segment of the population, and that certain segment of the population that would probably engage with that stuff the most are also the most likely to vote, right? It's a certain age, it's a certain ethnic group, you know. Actually, it's guys like us 20 years later than we are right now, who are the most likely to vote, who are the most likely to be politically engaged, and our generation isn't. And I would even say, and now there's a whole, man, I've been able to vote for 18 years. So when I say our generation, we're like middle of the pack now. those numbers are still super low. And so is it surprising? I don't know if it's necessarily surprising, because it's really easy to get those people to be angry, and it turns into votes. Whereas when we get, our generation and younger generations get angry, they just don't seem to be translating that into votes. You saw it even with our municipal election, right? Like, I haven't really looked at the data yet, but Did the voting population skew younger? Probably not. Maybe a little bit. The 2015 federal election, everyone was like, yes, the vote of the millennial. The millennials turned out. And what was that vote? Even 24%? I have no idea. I don't know. I can't remember. But it was still low.
Yeah.
It's just relative to the election before that. It was like gangbusters. So if we all voted, then sure, I don't think these people would have a chance. But we don't. So
it's an interesting thing. If more people voted, and that's something that I hear every single election, every time anyone talks about politics, if we had more voters, we would have better results. And I've said vocally for a long time that that's nonsense, because we have 50% of the population voting, and we have this same democracy that we've had forever. And I don't see that more voters are going to do anything except just continually vote whatever happens.
I wholeheartedly disagree, because that 50% tends to skew older and whiter and richer and straighter and you know, that is the base that's voting. For example, you know, look at our city, the fastest growing demographic is Indigenous,
mm-hmm.
right? But there's a demographic level, they don't tend to vote very much, similar to younger people, right? I think the more marginalized you are, probably the less inclined you are to vote, for whatever reason. But if we could get those people out, I don't think the populace would have a chance ever again.
It's an interesting concept. I always have thought that most people, when I see them vote, they're basing their votes on 3 to 5 things. And if that's what you think is important in an election, then you really have no clue what you're voting on. Because to run a country or a city or a province, you're talking about thousands of important issues that should be part of your decision-making on who you're voting for. But when you dumb it down to 3 or 5 things, then it doesn't really matter who you're voting for, because you have no idea what you're voting for. So if you have more people still basing it on 3 to 5 things, how can you expect a better result?
Well, I'll tell you what. As someone who studied political science, I would love if we had a 90% voter turnout so that we could see who was right. Because we've never had that chance. So if 90% of the population votes and I'm proven wrong, I will eat my hat. But I would love to have the opportunity to see whether or not it's true.
All right. And so now I'm going to switch gears a little bit here. With you being so involved with politics and understanding it and really diving deep into it to be informed, do you use any of that for like influences when you're writing songs and coming out stuff? You did mention that you write sad songs, but with mm-hmm. the current political climate, that easily could translate.
Huh. Yeah, I used to write, well, it's funny, like with my, I have like a new band that's like more heavier rock and stuff, and that's all politics. Like I don't, just kind of came out. But with like the folky stuff, I don't know, I used to a bit with my old band, there was some politics in there, but I tend to just write stuff down that sounds good and kind of go from there. I've never really sat down and been like, today I'm going to write a song about religion or whatever, you know? Excuse me, I just kind of, whatever sounds good, kind of sounds good.
You're drinking with your kids.
Yeah. Gotta do something about those kids.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, I've never really put that much thought into songwriting. It's kind of like breathing. Like, I can't not do it, you know? It's just, music will just always be something that I do in whatever capacity. Like, if I was sitting here right now, like, waiting for something, I would be playing the drums on my leg. If I'm in my car during traffic, like, stuck in traffic, I'm going to be harmonizing with the radio. If I'm walking down the street, I'm going to be humming a song. Like, it's like a compulsion.
So some of your friends or people you've met that have kind of, like, made it in the music industry and stuff like that, what sets them apart from other people that are kind of just doing it as a hobby?
Hard work, man. Just grinding as much as possible all the time. That's like the days of, you know, I once interviewed Roger Hodgson from Supertramp, and they got a six record deal just from like some dudes found them in a bar in like the 60s. And then they were just like, here's tons of money, you just keep writing songs and eventually you'll figure it out. And then they did. Like, I mean, how many Supertramp songs, you know, right? And everyone made a pile of money. Well, that doesn't happen anymore. There's like 8 bajillion bands, right? And everyone's super talented, and like, especially in Thunder Bay, man, like, you could walk into a room anywhere and you could probably put a band together. Like, in most places that you go into, if there's a decent crowd of people. You gotta want it, but the people I know who are actually doing it are the hardest working people that I know. You know, I look at, like, Coleman Hell and Misha and Robbie, they were here and they started something, and then they took it to Toronto, and the first time my band was in Toronto on tour, they came out to the show, and they were all living in, like, one room, right? And then they just kept grinding, and then we went back, like, 4 years later, and they played a show with us, and they'd just been signed to 604, which is, like, Chad Kroeger's label, right? And then they just kept grinding, and then the next time I went there for a visit, and we were having a drink, and they'd just been signed to Columbia, see, and they were going to play the, like, a Juno's, like, before or after party or something, but that was, like, yeah, a 6-year swing, or 5-year swing, and it was a constant grind for those guys every day. People are like, whoa, this Coleman Hell guy from Thunder Bay is an overnight sensation. It's like, no one's an overnight sensation, ever. And you not only have to have the talent, but you have to have the drive and dedication. And even if you have that drive and dedication, it still probably doesn't work out, you know? So I think that's the difference. Whereas, like, guys like me, I mean, man, if someone wants to pay me money to play music, giddy up. But am I gonna, like, constantly grind all the time and, like, eat raw Mr. Noodles and whatever else? No, because by default I'm a lazy, lazy man, you know? And I will always default to, like, the couch and, like, having a beer and playing FIFA. You know what I mean? And now with kids it's even worse. Like, what am I gonna do? Be like, sorry kids, I'm gonna go play the Palomino in Calgary for 2 months and make $5 a day. Daddy's gotta pursue his vision. Don't compromise. Don't make me compromise my art. You know. So I think that's the difference, though. It's like, you gotta believe in yourself, but you have to grind every day.
Do you find that Thunder Bay specifically has, like, a weird mentality that where they just don't seem to have the self-confidence to even think that they can go beyond Thunder Bay? You mentioned this before, that if you talk to someone a musician in Toronto, they'll say, oh yeah, I'm a musician, I play in a band, and, like, they're whatever, have their day job, a bartender, whatever, that they do to pay all of their bills, and then every once in a while they get a gig. But in Thunder Bay, there'll be guys that are, like, pretty good bands, and they're, like, successful in this town. But you ask them what they do, I'm like, oh yeah, I'm a carpenter. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I'm just from Thunder Bay, so I'm nothing, because Thunder Bay is just a small town. No one cares about it. And it's just a weird, like, mentality that this city has, that we don't think that we could be bigger than we are.
Yeah, I think part of that is, like, we have this culture of, like, it's that crab in the bucket thing, right? Is, like, you don't, everyone hates the guy that's, like, the self-promotion machine, talks about themselves too much or herself too much. And that goes for anything. That's from, like, songwriters to, like, you know, I don't know, soap sculptures to, like, the amount of times where I've met known people for years and then I don't even know that they're some sort of artist until I see their Facebook page online and I'm like, oh my god, that's so-and-so, I've known them for 20 years. That is such a Thunder Bay thing. But yeah, I think part of it is just, we have this, like, this crab in the bucket thing where it's like, if you try too hard and you're trying to climb out, everyone's gonna pull you back down, you know? So we've just sort of internalized it. It's like, we don't really celebrate our accomplishments that much, and we don't talk about ourselves that much, and, no one will say I'm a musician first at Thunder Bay. Man, even Rodney Brown, I bet if you asked Rodney Brown what he did for a living, he'd probably say something else, and the guy's been a musician for however many years, right?
Yeah. So last question I have for you. Who do you think would win in a street fight between a hot dog and a taco? And why?
I mean, Is the hot, does the hot dog have condiments on it, or is it just the hot dog in the bun?
Yeah, like standard ketchup, mustard, okay. Maybe a little bit of onions if it's like a weekend.
Okay, hot dog all day. Because, first of all, I'm assuming we're talking hard shell taco.
Yeah, sure.
Brittle. And it's got a lot of moving parts in there. You know, you've probably got some cheese and tomatoes and lettuce and the ground beef. It's going to get kind of messy with, like, one hit. Whereas a hot dog, like, man, I don't know, a hot dog could fall in a puddle. It would still kind of keep its core shape.
That's good reasoning. Well, thank you so much for being on the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And, yeah, it's been fun. Live from the living room. Thanks for coming, everybody.
And that's a wrap.